on page 18 now, and you've written at the top here, "Listen, son, this is the real world we're living in." So if you want to go on from there.
This is the system and the programming coming back at the explanation of how easy it is to control huge masses of people, and it can't handle it, so you're going to get hit and push back into your little box, your program box.
Right.
And the description here, this is, if a child repeatedly behaves destructively towards the people and property around them, you would expect their parents to be partly responsible. If a bank behaves unscrupulously, you would look to their directors. If a church, their chief priests. If a scientist or doctor, their respective professional bodies. If a country or government, its leaders. If the planet is in balance, the mentality of those who control governments. And what we're seeing is the Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, which everybody seems to look upward from the base,
yes,
is actually being inverted, and the downward arrow depicts domination and enslavement. So it's forcing us back into survival mode, which is the reptilian brain or the R complex or the stem brain.
Right.
So this is the system kicking in and trying to push us back.
Right.
Satisfied needs do not motivate. It's only the unsatisfied need that motivates. Next to physical survival, the greatest need of a human being is psychological survival. To be understood, to be affirmed, to be validated, to be appreciated. That's from The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey.
Right.
It's never going to happen. It can't. Because the truth might come out, reason might rear its ugly head, wisdom might show its face. Then what are we going to do? So to imbalance things, create war, mentally, emotionally and physically. You have divide and rule, you sow confusion, you force ignorance to create fear and obedience. You compel difference into prejudice. Just look around you, look at the environments.
Yes, yes. And this is another example of deft, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. There's imbalanced mentality creates imbalanced reality. The higher the level of such a mentality, the broader its impact.
Yes.
And we're coming on to Stanley Milgram again.
Okay.
We've got a quote here. "While structures of authority are of necessity present in all societies, advanced or primitive, modern society has the added characteristic of teaching individuals to respond to impersonal authorities. Whereas submission to authority is probably no less for an Ashanti than for an American factory worker, the range of persons who constitute authorities for the native are all personally known to him. While the modern industrial world forces individuals to submit to impersonal authorities so that responses are made to abstract rank indicated by an insignia, uniform or title." And this goes back to what we were, what the subjects were doing by passing on electric shocks to others.
Okay.
We mentioned previously about willing obedience. This is another quote from the same book. "Such institutions as business, the church, the government and the educational establishment provide other legitimate realms of activity, each justified by the values and needs of society and also, from the standpoint of the typical person, accepted because they exist as part of the world in which he is born and grows up. Obedience could be secured outside such institutions, but it would not be in the form of willing obedience, in which the person complies with a strong sense of doing the right thing. Ideological justification is vital to obtaining willing obedience. for it permits the person to see the behaviour as serving a desirable end. Only in this light is compliance easily exacted. So he talks about ideological justification.
Yep.
Let's break that down. That's an idea, so that's yep. right brain. It's logical, it's left brain. It's an ideal, so you're aiming for something.
Yes.
Maybe both frontal lobes. It's a justification, so you think you are right, you're doing the right thing. That is crucial in gaining willing obedience. And I'll come on to the ideological justifications in finance, religion, education, science and orthodox medicine. They're very clever tricks.
Yeah.
And if yeah. you don't know information outside of a limited awareness, you'll buy into them. Because they're on the surface, they're true, and it's what people want, or it's what yes. people expect there to be. But because it's an ideal, you never get to it, because you're never supposed to. And what it does, it buys in, you're bought in with eternal commitment, because you keep on feeding it and feeding it to get something, if only, if only, if only. It's never going to happen.
Yes, and I think it's grown to these institutions have grown to such a size that we've all become absorbed into them to a greater or lesser extent, or at least we have like our umbilical cords plugged into one or more parts of those networks to because that we need it to sustain ourselves, or at least that's what we think, and that's what we are encouraged to do.
We're plugged into them, whether we like it or not. Yeah. It's from cradle to grave. It's so-called education, mm. when in fact it's programming.
Yes.
And yes. we're too young to know the difference. It's money. It's religion. It's God. It's some higher force that we have to beseech or approach for something that we can't provide for ourselves. So we are subordinated. Every single time we're subordinated. I'll come on to that.
Okay, yeah,
in
great.
A bit more detail. Let's start with finance then. I'm not going to go into too many details. What I'm going to do is I've allied up the heart diagram where it becomes a plain heart, and then it goes into a wall, and then an igloo surrounding it with all these bricks, this bricked up heart.
Mm.
And I've then laid next to it particular subject matters, for example, finance. And there's nothing wrong with finance. In terms of cash and trading in cash and what have you. The ideological justification in finance is that trade brings prosperity, because it does. Well, it's supposed to, and it does for many. But as you do some research and you find out about the fractional reserve system, what it does, it creates debt. Money is created out of fresh air as debt, and you get charged interest on it. There's a way out of it, and it's called the Bradbury pound. And then it's an example in 1914 where the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, was requested in inverted commas by the Bank of England to print some money. And he ordered John Bradbury, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, in 1914 on the 7th of August to print money, because the Bank of England in effect told them to. Why? Well, they thought that we were all going to panic, run to the banks and take our money out because World War One had been declared.
Right.
Now, as it turned out, they were in such a rush or panic, they printed the money on one side to start with, And, well, the rush didn't happen. Because maybe we just don't think like certain people. Maybe we're thinking about family and provision and am I going to, you know, where am I going to be, you know, am I going to be an army, navy, where am I going to be posted to?
Right.
All those sorts yep. of human yep. things. Now, you've bought into the idea of trade brings prosperity because it does, but it would bring a hell of a lot more prosperity if the government of the day didn't borrow imaginary money from a central bank but printed its own money backed by the credit of that nation. That way, it doesn't borrow any money from a central bank. If it doesn't borrow any money, it doesn't have to pay any interest on it. And if it doesn't borrow any money, it hasn't got any money to pay back. The reason we're taxed is because it's the government has to pay back that money. If the government prints its own money backed by the credit of the nation, it can pay for roads and schools and hospitals and all the other public and councils and all the other public services and doesn't have to come to us anywhere near as much. There is a snag. If the government of the day goes bonkers and prints it all at once, we're all going to have a load more cash. What are we going to do with that cash? Go out and spend it on what? The same goods and services that haven't had a chance to grow. In other words, business rates will need to come down, interest-free loans to businesses to help grow their businesses. In the UK, there's supposed to be 6 million small to medium sized enterprises, SMEs. Let's suppose, just for the sake of broad brush, 4 million are supposed to be one-man bands. Let's forget those. No disrespect. 2 million are left. If those companies are not paying back interest, they could use that money to employ people, equipment and plant
mm-hmm.
and grow their businesses. Now, let's suppose half of them go for plant and equipment, the other half go for people. That's 1 million. Let's just say half of that, so 500,000 people. Not brilliant jobs, not anything but some sort of employment. Keep people off the streets. Anybody interested? And it's a gradual thing.
Yes.
Now, build the economy. Apparently the Guernsey pound, there's an article, if you Google or your search engine, is Guernsey pound and Louis Even, as in Even Stephen, but not Stephen, but Louis. Louis Even, there's a simple article about the Channel Island Guernsey pound after the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, where the banksters came in about 15 years later and stopped the process of Guernsey printing its own money.
Mm.
They wanted to build a town hall. They had labour available, they had materials available, but they didn't have any money, so they weren't going to do it. So the governor printed his own money.
Right.
And paid for it, and nobody was taxed.
Right. Yep.
It takes a while for this to happen, so I would tend to suggest, without getting too micromanaging on this, that this is explained to people, and the government of the day says, look, we'll just do the tokenistic things like reduce MOT by whatever it is, £5, your road tax by £5, you've got to be careful. But things where you're not going to get rich overnight, and maybe they could start eating into the council tax.
Okay. Yeah, so this whole idea of a nation printing its own money rather than a central bank, it's, you know, it's kind of alien to the way that things are set up now. Whereas at one time, 100 years or more ago, it would be much more logical to have done that, But now it seems that, it's not something that could be done according to you know, most mainstream economists, you know.
That's their programming.
Yes, exactly.
And they're kept ignorant of things like the Bradbury pound or the Guernsey pound.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, if you look at some of the quotes that are around concerning money and Montague, Norman and others, it's shocking when you realise what's going on.
Yes, yes.
And this is what happens when people... What's the expression? People who believe absurdities commit atrocities, except this time they know it and they're doing it deliberately. And they've got to keep us ignorant.
Yes.
Henry Ford said something about the... It's well enough that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning. Henry Ford. That's what he's talking about.
Yes, yes, and this is going back to the fractional reserve system. That's something I only learnt about 5 or 6 years ago, and I tried to have a conversation about this with somebody else, and they'd never heard of it and didn't understand that that's how banks operate. But it is how they operate, and you know, I used to be taught as a child, money doesn't grow on trees, and money doesn't grow on trees. It's true, but it is created out of thin air.
Absolutely.
So with the way that the system works. So you're then down to the point of, okay, so if this if I go into this building in London called A Bank, they can apparently legally say that they have a certain amount of money, and then the next day they can say that they have more money because they happen to have created it. So what gives? Why can't I just do that? Why can't I go into my house with a certain amount of money and then come out the next morning and say, well, now I've got this amount of money because I say so? You know, you're down to that.
Because if you did that, you'd be a criminal.
Exactly. So they're allowed to do things which for anybody else to do would be criminal. But what gives them that authority? You know, and you can't even say it's the Queen. Not that that would mean anything anyway. But then you get into the situation where that's the illusion. We're programmed to believe that that's a reality, but actually it's not real at all. It's just what a certain group of, going back to your point earlier on about a small minority ruling the majority, it's the small minority that have managed to convince everyone else around them that that's the way it is. That's the way, the only way that the system can work. If it worked another way, there'd all be terrible consequences for everybody. You know,
fear.
And that's the way that it works.
Absolutely. So if you want to survive, you'll comply.
Yeah.
Just to say that the Bradbury is backed by the credit of the nation. So yeah. The currency that in the UK that we have, if you look at the currency, it says, I promise to pay the bearer the sum of whatever it is, £5 or £10, let's say. And because it's credit, then you don't need to have, it's not a promissory note. It's backed by the infrastructure, the bridges and the roads and all the rest. So you don't need to have that written on it. Whatever it is, we need 100% confidence in it. And I've got a lot more confidence, although they're full of potholes, in our roads than I do the fresh air money that we've got in our pockets. What's even worse is it's not even backed by the gold standard, which we came out of, I think, in 1931. So you can't even go to a bank and say, right, give me the gold, these promissory notes. There's a few problems with this monetary setup. In 1609, the Bank of Amsterdam was formed, and what happened, as I understand it, I wasn't there, so I don't know, was that the Dutch were fighting the Spanish. I don't know why they're always fighting the Spanish, or the other way round, and they ran out of cash currency. So they got the precious metal dealers together and said, right, how much you got? We've got this much, right, we'll print these bits of paper up to this amount that you've got. we'll hand them out to everybody, that'll keep them quiet. Nobody seemed to notice, so they kept doing it and kept doing it. So you've got a fraction now of precious metals that are on reserve. That went on until, that was sort of like the pilot, the Bank of Amsterdam, and then we got the Bank of England in 1694. There's at least three big problems with this. It's been going on for hundreds of years, number one. Number two, it involves anyone who's anyone, which is all of us, except for, say, people in the bush. Number three, which is you cannot do this accidentally. You have had to have very cleverly planned this. Now, who is it who is that nasty, who has got it in for the whole of humanity, that has gone away and very, very cleverly put this together?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the question that you end up being confronted with, isn't it? When you look at all of this
stuff.
If
you want it, if you've got the guts to ask confront it. Yeah. I'll leave religion to the end.
Yes.
Because that's a big example of where we are deceived into giving our power away by looking out and upward. Outward and upward.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to comment on that when we get to that, yeah.
And this is what we seem to be doing with all these. There's always this authority figure, be it a banker or a bank manager or some authority figure here that seems to have it in for us, whether they know it or not. So let's look, going on to education. Instruction has deadened self-confident inquiry. That's Ivan Illich again, but this time in the right to useful unemployment. And education isn't education, it's really programming. You will follow these instructions, you will regurgitate these instructions, and you will be rewarded for regurgitating these instructions. If you look at the different types of intelligence, there are eight stated by David Gray in Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Children Are From Heaven. I've put seven main ones here. Academic, emotional, physical, creative, artistic, common sense, intuitive, and his eighth one is gifted intelligence. If you look at the suggested main brain hemisphere, you'll get a mixture of different ones. Academic is left brain, emotional, creative, and artistic. It's suggested here a right brain, physical, common sense, and intuitive, probably both. You could argue that either which way. It doesn't matter because the educational programming is academic and that's left brain. And that's what you see in the five sense world or what you can be made to see. True education, strengthening the powers of the mind, tries to balance all types of learning, which is a nightmare for any tyranny.
Yes, yes.
And just to make the point, or for Rabindranath Tagore to make the point about left brain, he says that a mind all logic is like a knife all blade. It cuts through the hand that uses it.
That's very good, yeah, very good. One thing that I just throw in here, you know, I was, because I've been involved in education, and I don't like to think I've indoctrinated anybody or given them programming instructions, certainly not been my intention, but I was taught some time ago the meaning of the word education, which is from the Latin, which is educo, which is to lead out. So in other words, this ties in with what I think, if I'm correct, maybe people who listen to this will write to me and tell me I'm wrong, but as far as I'm aware, this ties in with what's called the Socratic method, which is whereby you assume that everybody intuitively knows everything already because somehow, you know, they can establish this connection to universal knowledge, which we won't get on to talking about today, but I sort of do think that is true. If people were given an open-ended way of experiencing their environment, you could draw out from them things that they didn't think they knew, but actually they do know. And that to me is what I like to do as education, where you ask people, get people to ask themselves questions, and you teach them certain things, teach them a base level, and then you try and encourage them to move forward from there under their own thought processes, without prompting, without necessarily pushing them in a given direction. And that's where you, in other words, you're leading out these concepts from them. But there are not many tutors and teachers that do that. I don't think, not certainly not in schools and colleges. There are not that many that can do it well. And they, particularly now, as I said, you've got to follow a curriculum and a syllabus more closely than perhaps when I was in education. So there's less opportunities to do that anyway.
And where were those teachers before that time? In the programming schooling system?
Yes.
So it's going to be very difficult. You may occasionally find one.
Yes, yes.
But that's the whole point. It's to self-perpetuate. We have something here to... You've got to buy into this programming system, which we call education. So the buy-in or the ideological justification in this case is... Well, what do you want it to do? You want it to prepare people as responsible adults.
Yes.
Or yes. Some such thing.
Yes.
As that. And you get your basics like read, write, arithmetic. And then you build on that, and it, you get into reports and tests. And then external examinations and obedience training. And as you go up this picture with the heart and the wall, the walled heart picture, each time you go up a level, it's a bad copy, an archontic bad copy. That's what the archontic realm does. They make bad copies of things. And then as you go up again, you get a bad copy of a bad copy. So it becomes more and more restrictive, which is consistent with a dictatorship or tyranny, and it restricts. You can't think this, you can't think that, you've got to do this, you've got to do that.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And this idea of bad copies, like making a photocopy of a photocopy. And
yes, exactly. Mechanised as well. Science, again, it's a similar type of thing. You might view it as a branch of programming. This is a quote from Professor Richard Feynman, a Nobel laureate in physics, 1988. If your theories and mathematics do not match the experiment, you are wrong.
Yep.
Now, science can be used in a balanced way. Heat, power, shelter, food, distribution... but too often, as we've mentioned before, we're always blowing each other to pieces. And if we ever do get anything, it's a spin-off from blowing each other to pieces.
This is so often the case. And, again, you're down to creating an enemy or, you're creating a perceived enemy even, and having this... feeling that you need to then use the science to create something to attack the enemy before the enemy attacks you. And, then you're involved in this eternal arms race, both in terms of an offensive capability and a defensive capability.
There's an orthodox medicine approach, which I'll come on to, but
okay.
It's exactly what you've just said there. There's a perfect quote for that.
Okay.
He describes a Vietnam War, and he links it with cancer treatment. But we'll come on to that.
Okay.
I just wanted to mention a book by Richard Milton called Forbidden Science, and a brief ish quote. Paul Kammerer, that's with a K, A-M-M-E-R-E-R, a distinguished experimental researcher, evolutionary mechanism, the inheritance of acquired characteristics. I've abridged it.
Yes.
Bred spotted salamanders on different coloured soils and found that over successive generations they changed colour to resemble that of the soil on which they were bred. When the offspring of these genetically modified salamanders were moved to the opposite colour soil to their parents, their coloration changed back again. Camera, now bred from such artificial elongated specimens, this is the sea squirt Siona, I think that's called, and found that elongated siphons were inherited. Simple direct evidence of inheritance of an acquired characteristic, something that Darwinists believe impossible.
Yeah.
So yes. That's something for people to think about.
Yes, and I mean, a prime example of how a mainstream scientific idea has been established as fact, but is contradicted by the evidence, which goes back to Richard Feynman's quote that you started to read out in this section.
Jumping ahead to the walled heart diagram.
Yep.
The buy-in to this particular subject matter, the ideological justification I'm suggesting, is understanding nature to benefit mankind, because that's what most of us would think it would be.
Yes. Yes.
And just occasionally, as I've said, we do get some sort of benefit. Well, you would have thought so with the billions and trillions that go into it. But unfortunately, as we've mentioned, it turns out to be spin-offs from military applications. Moving on to orthodox medicine now, or complementary healing. The functionary of contemporary medicine is in a different position. His first orientation is treatment, not healing. That's Limits to Medicine from Ivan Illich. Again, coming back to your example with science, there's a quote from Virtual Medicine by Dr. Keith Scott Mumby.
Okay.
And he says here, instead we get the spectacle of doctors trying to fight a disease such as cancer with the mentality of the Vietnam War. The approach to kill everything in sight, killing good and bad in the hope of annihilating the very last enemy cell while turning the terrain into defoliated wasteland. It didn't work on the larger scale, and it violates common sense to suppose it will work on a biochemical scale. And it's a perfect example of what you were saying.
Yes, and I'll just say at this point, for people listening, to sort of tie in with this, that it, with conventional allopathic medicine and cancer treatments now, as we speak in 2017, the options, the basic options that you are given, haven't changed in almost 100 years. And those options are, when you go to a hospital for treatment, hospital ward, they basically will say to you, depending on the type of problem you have and depending on if you're given any options, for treating cancer, we can cut you, we can burn you, or we can poison you. Which would you like, or would you like a combination of those three? And that's essentially the only three options that you are given now, and that's been the case for about 100 years. And this ties in with this, you know, the killing thing. We have to kill the cancer, so we'll kill a bit of you as well, you know, while we go along, if you don't mind. Thank you very much. And of course, you know, again, we could do a whole many hours on the alternatives to that, which are not talked about.
Another example back in the day in medicine is the pleomorphic theory versus the monomorphic theory. Louis Pasteur apparently stole some work from a French contemporary of his called Antoine Bechamp. Antoine Beauchamp was looking down his microscope and he saw things that he called microzymes, small bodies. And he thought they had something to do with disease. Louis Pasteur said that the germ, it's only a theory, germ causes disease. Now, if you've got a microscope that can only see a certain amount and somebody's got is a funny colour and they're not well and you look at their blood or whatever, tissue sample, and you keep seeing different things in there that a healthy person doesn't have, you will tend to think that whatever that is underneath your microscope is causing the problem. Antoine Beauchamp thought, well, hang on, there's something else before that. And he thought that the environment affected these microzymes and it then became what we call a bacteria or a virus or whatever that we think today causes whatever the condition is. Gaston Naissens also, he was a microbiologist and he did some work on this, I think, in 1950s and 60s. He said, there's a quote here from the Medical Mafia by Dr. Guylain Langteau. And she says, thanks to this famous microscope, Gaston Naissens was able to describe the complete cycle of a somatid. He called them somatids as opposed to microzymes. In a healthy environment, it goes somatid spore, double spore, then it returns to somatid. In an environment in poor health, the somatid does not change back into a somatid after the double spore phase. It enters into a cycle of 16 different forms. Each person can see with their own eyes the state of their immune system and determine their own state of health if they get a live blood sample. And I hope one day that we'll be able to have those in medical centres, healing centres, and people can say, right, I'm eating too much rubbish because my blood is doing this, or it's this shape, or it's clumping together. One of the factors that affects this is pH. You have the acid alkaline scale where 7 is neutral, 1 is strongly acidic, 14 is strongly alkaline. The blood is, I think, 7.365 pH. If things start to become too acidic and increases in acidity, I understand that it goes from bacteria, add more acidity, it becomes virus, then to it carries on to fungus and then to mould and then to decay. And if you look at the rubbish that we're stuffing down our faces, it's hugely out of balance. Do please look at websites like Good Health Naturally with Robert Redfern. And there's a great deal of importance with fluoride as well. Fluoride gobbles up iodine. Iodine's very important in the thyroid gland. The medical profession used to use it if people were hyperthyroidism. Mm. In other words, an overactive thyroid. And it's also important in women in breast tissue and ovaries, and it's suggested somewhere that the lack of iodine, there's some issue with hormone control and you tend to get cysts on their ovaries. And when people start picking up their iodine levels, the cysts tend to recede. And breast tissue, it's very important in the hormonal cycle and the cell apoptosis, so you actually clear out any breast tissue that isn't you know, that needs to be got rid of. If you won't do it, if you haven't got enough iodine, you need selenium to, if you like, activate. It's a cofactor, and selenium's anti-cancer. For fellas, it's prostate, selenium and iodine, especially selenium. And selenium's known to be anti-cancer, have anti-cancer effects. So,
and certainly iodine is relatively easy to get hold of, isn't it? And selenium as well. It's not. I'm not.
Yeah, you can. You can get. There's Good Health Naturally. Although I'm not trying to sort of sell anything but that's one potential avenue. Dr. Mark Circus is the other website. He does a lot, all sorts of things.
Right, great. So. Yeah, I'm not a name I'm familiar with. The other thing I'll just mention briefly before we move on a little way is going back to the Gaston Neesons and Somatids. A name we were talking about earlier before we started recording this was Wilhelm Reich. Wilhelm Reich actually made similar discoveries independently, and he called them bions. So, in other words, microzymes? And the somatids, Reich discovered an equivalent, and he called them bions. And I think he's written quite a lot about those. And there was a couple of other people that have discovered the same thing as well. They're like more basic forms of that life, like pre-life, aren't they, almost?
Yeah.
Or pre-bacteria, or I think there's something called proto-bacteria in biology, but they're even before that, I think. And I've actually seen that you can create these. You use an iron filing under a microscope to get an iron filing, and you get some potassium chloride solution. Put the iron filing in that, you boil it, you flame the microscope slide on a Bunsen burner or whatever, and you heat the potassium chloride. I think it's 0.1 molar, the solution, something like that, or maybe 0.01 weak solution, and these things will appear, and you can after about 20 minutes. So it's a repeatable experiment. If you look up, you'll be able to. In fact, I need to do this myself because I have got a microscope and I have got a microscope which has a video attachment, so I'm wanting, and I have to do that sometime before too long. Right, okay, so
You might think that complementary healing is complementary to orthodox medicine. It isn't. It is complementary to the energy needs of the patient in order to restore balance. So there is little room for orthodox medicine, hence the hostility. Now, I'm not talking about intensive care, emergency treatment, some of the best there is. We're not talking about that. We're very often talking about chronic disease issues that are mega money issues. And very often it's to do with diet. Very often it's to do with getting minerals that have been taken out from the soil because of the sort of monoculture intensive farming practices. If you haven't got the right amount of minerals, your digestive enzymes aren't going to work. I don't think vitamins work too well either. If you don't digest your food properly, you've got problems. And problems and problems, and very often, because of its nature, chronic problems. And if you don't keep your gut flora healthy, you'll get even more problems.
That's it. The diet is a sort of you are what you eat, as somebody, as many people have said, and it's true. And it underpins health. The diet underpins health. And I think medical school students typically do about an hour out of their whole 5 years of study on diet. So I've heard, but in the Western world.
Oh yeah, 4 hours or something. Yeah. Something. It's not very much at all. What does that say?
Exactly.
Now, back to the walled heart picture. The buy-in for this is, or the ideological justification, is to take away the pain and make people better again.
Yep.
And I'm sure nobody's going to disagree with that. And you get bad copies of that. You get pain-killing, you get cure, you get care, which is copied into pain-blocking drugs and leading on to dependency. We're not dealing with cause. And then the bad copy of that is addiction and iatrogenic illness or even death. That's iatrogenic means doctor cause.
Yes. And the fact that we have a word for that, iatrogenic, is kind of
Well,
it's quite sad, isn't it? Very sad.
The summary sheet now.
Do you want to go back and do the religion?
I was just about to say, yeah, let's go back and do the religion. But you see there are four examples there that are expressed of that walled heart.
Yes.
We've mentioned about the ideological justification, and in religion's case, it's love your neighbour as yourself. I'm sure no one's going to disagree with that. That gets... you'll have your ethics, your prayer and your meditation, nothing wrong with that. That gets bad copied into beliefs, and then bad copies scripture, dogma and faith. So yeah. that's the way up from there.
Yes.
There's a lot to say about religion, but I'll keep it reasonably brief.
Okay.
The devil, this is a quote from John Cooper Powers.
Okay.
The devil is any god who begins to exact obedience. And this ties in with the Milgram question, and it ties in with compliance, our behaviour. Arthur Findlay says, this is in The Suppression of Knowledge by Michael Roll, to confuse Jesus, the Jewish teacher and healer, with the Christ, the 17th pagan saviour god, is a gross historical blunder. Jesus was officially made into God at the Council of Nicaea in AD 325, the second person in a trinity of gods. What Christian knows that?
Yeah.
They don't.
Very few.
Unless you're very, very lucky. Here's a quote from the Messianic Legacy, Michael Baigent. That's Baigent.
Yep.
In the early 16th century, Pope Leo X is on record as declaring, "It has served us well, this myth of Christ."
A very good one.
And one more quote just to... finish off, because people do get... Well, actually, let me say this.
There's, yes.
Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches, or the Inquisition, from 1257 to 1816. Wholesale, systematic terrorism, torture and murder. Why? What on earth has that got to do with love your neighbour as yourself? It hasn't. Johann Most, German philosopher. The more man clings to religion, the more he believes. The more he believes, the less he knows. The less he knows, the more stupid he is, the easier he can be governed. The easier to govern, the better he may be exploited. The more exploited, the poorer he gets. And the poorer he gets, the mightier the domineering forces grow. The more the riches and power they amass, the heavier their yoke among the neck of the people.
Very interesting. So true.
And there's all sorts of problems with the story of Jesus. There's
dear Murdoch, indeed.
Murdoch,
yes.
Was it?
Was, yes.
And others have highlighted serious shortcomings with that. And also the Gnostics, who were around before the Christians, who talked about the oneness, that we're all one consciousness and that we're just different manifestations of the same. So if we attack each other, we're just attacking ourselves. And that tends to go back onto love your neighbour as yourself.
Exactly, and that's where that concept perhaps comes from originally. But like so many others, it's kind of been subverted and ended up being... Another kind of segment of the what I call the control grid.
Bad copy.
A bad copy, yeah. Mm. Yeah, bad copy is right. And so what I would like to comment on this whole idea of, you know, we've mainly just very briefly come out with some quotes and mentioned Christianity, and of course there are many other religions. I think there's 34,000 branches of Christianity. Was what somebody told me. I've never gone and counted them, but I can imagine that's probably a fairly good figure. But my main point that I wanted to make is that this whole idea, and this particularly became even more starkly apparent to me when I started looking at this DM Murdoch's work, and there are others that have followed the similar path, looking at the astrological symbolism that's within the story of Christ and other stories, and just throwing in a couple of things like the story where Jesus walks on water, and that can be interpreted as the sun reflecting on the water, that, you know, because the sun is Jesus, and Jesus is said to be the Son of God, which is the synonymous with the physical sun, which then goes back to ancient Egypt and Ra and all of that, and Osiris, Horus, and all that trinity of the Egyptian gods. But then, as we were saying before the conversation, you look at the time that we're at now in the year, which is at Easter time or just after as we record this, and Easter moves around in the Christian calendar. Jesus died on a certain date of the year, did he not? So why does the date of his alleged death have to move around? And curiously enough, it moves in relationship to the phase of the moon. So where in the Bible does it speak of any relationship, or any of the Christian texts speak of a relationship between the phase of the moon and Christ and what Christ was doing? The answer is nowhere, because, and I hate to say it, but this is what the Jehovah's Witnesses point out, or that's where I first heard about it, that what the story of Easter is got nothing to do with the story of Jesus. It's essentially a pagan festival which to get Christianity accepted in Europe, at least, I don't know about the rest of the world, they had to superimpose it on the existing pagan beliefs. So that's one aspect which you cannot not understand that. You cannot, you know, deny that Christmas is 3 days away from the winter solstice. You know, it's a fact. You can't deny it, the way that our calendar is arranged. And it's not a coincidence. Going on from there, and going back to some of the what we were talking about earlier on, about, so what we haven't said in the conversation is that this idea of giving away your power, and this is what religion, and particularly Christianity, has encouraged people to do on a spiritual level. Because, as I said, you hear this word God a lot, and it's God doesn't necessarily mean a Christian God. It doesn't necessarily mean a religious God. Or what it means for many people is something which is outside of themselves, some greater force than them, which is they are not worthy of communicating with that. So what you do is, with religion and particularly Christianity, is you externalize this force. This force is disconnected from you, and to understand that force, you have to go to a church or a religious figure, and they're your intermediary. You then go through them, so you discharge your responsibility for knowing this force of God, or whatever you want to call it, to them, and you primarily take on board their descriptions of God, their characterizations. It's not something you ever think about directly experiencing yourself. And essentially, this idea of a discarnate male entity, as I call it, it's a trick. It's a trick that they came up with. And in other words, you know, going back 1,000 years, the learned ones who'd read these scriptures, and the few that were able to read them, could basically use that to control other people. And they could say, well, okay, so God rules everything, he runs everything, we have to follow certain guidelines that God has laid down. I'm going to tell you what those guidelines are, and these are the guidelines, the Ten Commandments or whatever it is. I interpret those for you, so you live by those. And so this is where you become disconnected from your own inner knowing, and this is what Gnosticism was about, inner knowing, inner knowledge, inner understanding. And that to understand this, and to understand how disempowering most, if not all, religions are, you have to understand that you've, this concept of God has been externalized, and you become disconnected from this spiritually. When that's not true, essentially you are connected to God. You're connected to God as soon as you your soul entered your body or you became conscious in this world, you were connected to God at that point. And gradually, you know, and when I say God, I mean this greater consciousness. So going back to what you said a few minutes ago, we are all one. And you can experience this super consciousness yourself in certain altered states of consciousness through drugs, through life experiences. You and I were talking about near-death experiences in the past. That's a time when you experience this super consciousness. Read up about near-death experiences. But this is something, near-death experience, I think, which is something which shows that we have an expanded consciousness, which is partly inside of our heads, but is also whatever is inside our heads is connected to that as well. And it's not just inside our heads, it's somewhere else as well.
Well, Wilder Penfield, the Canadian neuroscientist, stimulated people's brains externally. There's no neurons, sensory neurons, so there's no pain. And somewhere in the temporal lobe, their consciousness came out and they could see themselves on the table with him sitting next to them, or standing next to them with a probe.
I didn't know
that.
There's
some spot in the temporal lobe, and apparently it's also in the front right lobe as well. There's supposed to be some sort of area there that's linked with higher consciousness.
But I've started to go off into other areas now, and so I want to bring myself back to come back to some other, because you've got some other things in the booklet here, haven't you, as well?
The summary picture, I just wanted to... this is with the walled heart.
Yep.
And you've got five, finance, religion, education, science, orthodox medicine. It's summary at the top. And what you're looking at are all these different bad copies and how they relate to our personal equivalent, if you like, and how they manifest in the world. But there's also, you're looking actually through prison bars. And if you look carefully at the prison bars, you'll see written on the horizontal ones, there's a covert, malevolent authority figure behaviour appearing as sincere, benevolent authority figure behaviour. Mm. And this is where we don't see through it.
Yeah, yeah.
We get suckered by the ideological justification. And as you go up from ideological justification for willing obedience, you start creating distance between subject and victim. And that lessens the subject's disobedience. And then you get enough distance for cold-blooded acts of brutality, as Stanley Milgram's work has shown and tried to explain regarding the Nazis in Germany. That whole summary sheet fits in over the page to a global overview, which is sat within a globe of the Earth, and there are cracks all over it, which are the seven questions that have been talked about.
Yeah.
And they're intrinsic in destroying basically the earth and us with it. Kill, kill, kill.
Yes.
At the back of the booklet in Appendix 1, there are different lists of deadening authority figure talk and a complementary thought police alternative.
Okay.
So we've gone into one of those, for example, practice makes perfect, when it's practice makes permanent.
Yeah.
And there are many others which are there for people to...
So that's an example of kind of unpicking the psychology that you could argue is behind many of these other commonly trotted out phrases. You know, why, what the programming is behind... why we come out with those, some of those common phrases. That's what you've put in Appendix 1.
Yes. It's you can see through the brick wall.
Yeah.
You're trying to get a bit more to the truth. Very often these things can be right, but they're not true. So what's the difference then between right and wrong and the truth?
Yeah.
Don't know. Well, once upon a time when you were very little, you knew what was true because you listened to what was in your heart. You didn't know anything about right or wrong. Right or wrong comes from an authority figure, usually mum or dad. And quite often it can be loaded. And we confuse the two because there's consequences and punishments and pressure and stress and all the rest. And, you know, survival issues or perception of survival issues. And once you get into that, the truth very rarely gets a look in.
Absolutely. Yes. And then following that, you've got the simplified explanation of brain function. Did you want to make any comments on that?
Yes, it's just to say there's sort of basic stuff, the frontal lobes, left side's more linked with logic and reason, the right side, intuition, creativity, vision, access to truth and wisdom. Underneath that's the limbic system or emotional brain. And that's associated with other aspects of the brain, like the hippocampus, amygdala especially. And then underneath that's the brain stem.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And that's associated with reflexes and also conditioned psychic reflexes, which Pavlov's work showed us with dogs. And part of the reason dogs were used was because their metabolism is similar to ours. Nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
This is a quote from Battle for the Mind by William F. Sargent. Various types of belief can be implanted in many people. After brain function has been sufficiently disturbed by accidentally or deliberately induced fear, anger or excitement. Of the results caused by such disturbances, the most common one is temporarily impaired judgment and heightened suggestibility. Its various group manifestations are sometimes classed under the heading of herd instinct and appear most spectacularly in wartime, during severe epidemics, and in all similar periods of common danger, which increase anxiety and so individual and mass suggestibility. So you're backing into believing what the authority figure tells you.
Mm-hmm.
If you get angry, frightened or excited enough, the way I look at it is that your frontal lobes eject and you're left with the limbic system. And if you keep piling on the pressure, that goes. And then it's the stem brain, and that's you're either with me or against me.
So you're peeling back those layers depending on the level of stress.
Or perception of fear. Whatever it is that you've put there, because they become more suggestible and more amenable to authority. So you're creating suitable environments or situations that provoke you to react and become suggestible. You start thinking, deadening authority figure talk or daft. You demand what the authority figures want you to demand. And if they are malevolent, what they have already planned for. This is the problem, reaction, solution situation.
Mm. Yes. And it appears that, you know, whoever has set this up, because I think it has been set up by somebody, we haven't spoken a lot about that, knows this. In other words, this design, the way that the system is designed, it hasn't necessarily been thrown together. It hasn't necessarily been evolved. It's been carefully constructed over a period of time to basically pen us in spiritually and physically, so that we can barely, you know, we have little chance of escaping while we're in a normal physical body, at least.
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of do it, but it's really tough. It's really tough. And then you've got some more quotes in the inside back cover here.
If you turn your life into a campaign against things, the things you fight will expand. Decide what you are for. And I suppose that's a much more sensible way of trying to be sort of positive, or why you need to try and be constructive. So you take into account the positive and negative, and you build a world. It's Mahatma Gandhi's become the world you want to be.
Okay, well, if people want to get copies of this booklet, which is, I recommend, you know, would be a good thing to do, I will have some copies. I can contact Totus to get some more. He has a few. You'll find some links to download it from my website, which is checktheevidence.com. And I don't think, Totus, you've given any other interviews about this, have you? Or have you? Correct me. I don't. You've decided that, that you wanted to sort of get this out there after a perhaps a number of years thinking about that. And so I hope that this will help people break out of some of the mental shackles which we are subject to, and kind of short circuit or, you know, dissolve some of the programming and make it a bit clearer, you know, how these systems are functioning, and help you to move forward in what I would sometimes called or cornerly called a spiritual journey, but that's what it is, really. It is a spiritual journey that you are on, and I hope that it will help people listening to this move forward in that journey. And I don't know whether anything you want to finish on, Totus, but I'd like to thank you for spending time with me today to go through this and for putting this together and the time that you spent doing that.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I'd just add one reference. That's Mark Passio, the Matrix trilogy, and he deconstructs the three films, and that's certainly worth pursuing.
Okay. Yeah, and another interesting speaker, Mark Passio, and... Yes, so once again then, Totus, thank you very much for your time today, and we'll hope that this will go out to people at some point in the near future, and they will get something out of it.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.